Did you know the Thomistic Institute offers two full-ride scholarships for the Master's in Theology at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C.? If you or someone you know has a passion for the Catholic intellectual tradition, especially the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, this could be the opportunity of a lifetime. Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships to learn more and apply today. This is a competitive scholarship. To be considered, please apply for the 2025 to 2026 academic year by January 28, 2025, the Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
How exactly are we to understand our nature as human beings? Are we fundamentally material beings, immaterial beings, or some combination of both? And of course, the first two groups of questions are directly relevant to those in the third and final group, which have to do with human death. What happens to us at death? Evidently, we cease to be alive, but does this entail that we cease to exist altogether, or do we somehow survive our death? In the remainder of my talk, I want to explore Aquinas' answers to these three groups of questions, and I'll do so by comparing his answers with those that have been traditionally given by proponents of some other, more familiar conceptions of human beings. In contemporary philosophy, as you may know, it's standard to distinguish two main conceptions of human nature, namely materialism and substance dualism, based on the different types of answers they give to our mind-body questions. Eventually, we'll see that it's worth distinguishing a third possible conception, one that's not always kept distinct from these other two. But for now, we can begin by focusing on just the standard conceptions, and in particular, let's start with materialism. According to materialism, we're wholly material beings. Thus, we can be said to have material parts like arms, legs, cells, tissues, and so on, but no immaterial parts, and certainly no immaterial minds or souls. Nowadays, materialists tend to avoid all talk of the soul, and some go so far as to deny that human beings even have minds. But for our purposes, it will be useful to focus on a version of materialism that identifies human beings with their bodies, and human minds with their brains. Indeed, for our purposes, it will be useful to think of materialism in terms of the five claims which I've listed at C on your handout. These are M1 through M5. So first claim, there's exactly one type of substance required to account for our nature, wholly material substances. Second claim, our bodies are those type of substances. Third claim, our minds are material parts of those substances, namely our brains, and of course we're identical to our bodies, and we possess our minds as fully material parts, and it follows from these first four claims that five, we are by nature fully material beings. For the sake of clarity, we can illustrate this conception pictorially using Aquinas' favorite example of a human being, Socrates. So here's Socrates' body, here's his mind. His body is a material substance. His mind is a part of that substance. That little dot represents the relation of being part of the part of it. And Socrates, on this view, is identical to his body. I'm glad those colors show up. Okay, so much for materialism. Let's now turn to the second main conception of human beings, substance dualism. Unlike materialists, substance dualists appeal to two different types of substance to explain our nature. One material, the other immaterial. Like materialists, substance dualists identify human bodies with wholly material substances. But unlike them, they identify human minds or souls with wholly immaterial substances. And, significantly, they identify human beings themselves with their minds or souls. For the sake of contrast with materialism, we can also think of substance dualism in terms of five claims. These are the ones listed at D on the handout, D1 through D5. So, first, there are exactly two types of substance required to account for our nature, wholly material and wholly immaterial substances. Our bodies are wholly material substances. Our minds are wholly immaterial substances. We're identical to our minds and possess our bodies. This is significant by exercising causal control over them. And it follows from this, these first four claims that we are by nature wholly immaterial beings. Once again, we can illustrate this conception pictorially for the particular case of Socrates. So here's his body and his soul. Once again, his body is a material substance. But this time, instead of being a part of a material substance, Socrates' soul is a wholly immaterial substance. And the relation between them is not parthood, but some kind of causal connection. And again, Socrates, instead of being identical to his body, is identical to his soul. Now, substance dualism is a conception of human beings that goes back at least to Plato. Indeed, Aquinas just thinks of it as the Platonic view of human nature. Nowadays, however, it's more common to associate this conception with Descartes. Indeed, it's often referred to now simply as Cartesian dualism. It's worth noting, however, that there's another conception of human nature distinct from both materialism and substance dualism, which is sometimes associated with Descartes. According to this conception, which we can refer to as trialism, because it invokes three different types of substance, human beings are identified not with their souls or with their bodies, but rather with a type of complex substance composed of each. For the sake of completeness, let's characterize trialism in terms of five claims. And I put these at E on the handout. So here we see it starts with the claim that there are three types of substance required to account for our nature. Wholly material substances, wholly immaterial substance, and complex substances that are partly composed of each. Second, our bodies are wholly material substances. That it shares in common with both of the first two conceptions. The third claim is our minds or souls are wholly immaterial substances. This is a claim it shares in common with substance dualism. But then it becomes distinctive in the next two claims. T4 says we're identical to complex substances, partly composed of each of those other two types, and possess our bodies and minds as parts. And of course, it follows from this that we are by nature part immaterial and part immaterial beings. Thus, in the case of Socrates, we've got three different substances. His body, which is a material substance, his soul, which is an immaterial substance, and Socrates himself, which is distinct from both, but composed of, or having as parts, each of those other two types. And it's because those other two parts are related in such a way as to give rise to this other substance. Okay, having distinguished these three traditional conceptions of human nature, we can now turn to what used to be called the $64,000 question. Now it should be like a $1 billion question. Which of these is best? Of the three, I think it's clear that materialism is the dominant contemporary conception of human nature, at least among philosophers. This shouldn't be surprising, given the prevalence of naturalism, that is, the doctrine that everything that exists, or at least all of contingent reality, is wholly material. It's important to see, however, that as a theory of human beings, materialism has a lot going for it, quite apart from any connection to naturalism. In particular, it has some significant general theoretical virtues. For one thing, it's theoretically parsimonious, that is to say, it just posits one type of substance and one that we've seen to anyway. It also makes good sense of the unity of human minds and bodies. Human minds are connected to bodies just by being part of them, and this is something which we'll see substance dualists have traditionally struggled with. In addition to these sorts of virtues, it also does a good job of upholding common sense views about the materiality of human beings. In particular, it preserves our pre-theoretical conception of ourselves as bodies of a certain type, namely organisms. And for the same reason, it can make good sense of our intuitions about the goodness of the human body and the badness of human death. If we just are our bodies, of course our bodies are good for us. And if death destroys our body, of course that's bad for us. Along each of these parameters, therefore, materialism clearly has a lot going for it. It needs to be emphasized, however, that materialism is not only the dominant conception of human nature among contemporary philosophers, it's also the conception of choice for many contemporary Christian philosophers. That is, philosophers like Peter Van Inwagen, Hud Hudson, Trenton Merritt, and others who, like Aquinas, allow their conception of human beings to be influenced by their theology. Nor is it hard to see why. Scripture and tradition themselves seem to offer considerable support for the materiality of human beings. For example, there are biblical passages such as Genesis 3:19, where dust you are and to dust you will return, which strongly suggest that we're material substances, or bodies, and indeed that death involves our corruption or destruction as such. And there are Christian doctrines like the resurrection of the body and the incarnation of Christ, which also put great emphasis on the goodness of the human body and the badness of human death. As is often pointed out, however, especially by other Christian philosophers and theologians, despite these advantages, materialism is at a serious disadvantage when it comes to preserving common sense and traditional Christian teachings about the immateriality of human beings. In particular, materialism has a hard time accounting for our differences from non-human animals, especially if we take these to include something that Christians and other major monotheists have traditionally insisted on, namely that we somehow bear the image of God. God's wholly immaterial, and we're in his image, we seem to be. It seems like we must be at least partly immaterial. What's more, materialism also has a hard time accounting for traditional Christian views about the immortality of the soul and traditional Christian views about the afterlife. But both of these things also enjoy considerable support from Scripture and tradition. Thus, in addition to passages like that from Genesis, quoted a minute ago, there are also passages like this one from Ecclesiastes. The dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit, or soul, returns to God who gave it. Passages like this appear to emphasize our connection to a soul that can exist apart from the body. Again, consider Christ's famous words to the thief on the cross, who asked Christ to remember him in his kingdom. In response, Christ says, "I tell you the truth. Today you will be with me in paradise." This passage is traditionally taken to refer to a time after death and prior to the resurrection when the thief will exist in a disembodied state. This is sometimes called the interim state. Indeed, on the traditional view of the afterlife, rewards and punishments for what we've done in this life will be distributed by God during this interim state. Here's a passage from Aquinas where he clearly commits himself to this traditional view. He says, "Because the souls of human beings are capable of receiving glory or punishment immediately after they have been separated from the body, they will immediately receive one or the other. Neither the reward of the good nor the punishment of the bad is put off until the souls take up their bodies again." Obviously, materialism is going to have a hard time handling traditional Christian views of this. That's why I put it on red. Red means you're doing bad along these parameters. Okay, for anyone committed to traditional Christian views about immortality of the soul and the afterlife, therefore, it might appear that we should abandon materialism in favor of something more like substance dualism. For in that case, we'll be able to make good sense of those aspects of common sense and tradition that uphold the immateriality of human beings. I suspect that it's precisely this sort of thought that explains why substance dualism has always been popular among Christians. Even so, substance dualism appears to have some pretty significant costs of its own. Indeed, it appears to fall short along precisely those parameters that materialism succeeds. So here they are again. In the case of substance dualism, it's obviously not theoretically parsimonious. On the contrary, it invokes two types of substance rather than just one. It effectively denies the unity of human minds and bodies, saying it amounts to no more than causal connection. And it violates the common sense intuition that we are organisms or living bodies, and it also seems to minimize the goodness of the human body and the badness of death. In fact, you might think, why do we need a body or a soul? What's so bad about no longer being in control of a certain hunk of matter? Of these various costs, contemporary materialists often emphasize substance dualism's failure to preserve intuitions about our relationship to our bodies. Trenton Merricks puts the point well. He says, "I think that when you look in the mirror or look down at your hands, you can see yourself, because you're a material thing. And when you hold your child, you do exactly that. These claims imply that we are not souls of the sort imagined by substance dualism." In fact, I kind of wonder what happens when you hug your child if you're a substance dualist. I guess you just drive one body into the body controlled by another person. Aquinas, by contrast, tends to emphasize substance dualism's failure to preserve the unity of minds and bodies and the badness of human death. As, for example, when he says, Plato maintained that the relation of the soul to the body is like that of a sailor to a ship, or that of one who is clothed to his clothing. But this position cannot be upheld, for if the soul were in the body as a sailor's in a ship, it would follow that the unity of soul and body is accidental. And then death, which brings about their separation, would not be a substantial corruption, which is obviously false. And of course, all this might make us wonder whether substance dualism is really better off than materialism after all. In fact, it might make us wonder how both of these first two traditional conceptions fare relative to our third. Now, as it happens, trialism has not received the sort of detailed analysis or attention from philosophers and theologians that materialism and substance dualism have. This is unfortunate, as trialism appears to have a number of things going for it as a conception of human nature. Indeed, it might appear to be the only one capable of doing justice to both the materiality and immateriality of human beings. Now, admittedly, trialism can't be regarded as theoretically parsimonious. Indeed, insofar as it appeals to three different types of substance, it's clearly worse off with regards to parsimony than either materialism or substance dualism. What's more, it cannot quite preserve the common sense intuition that we just are our bodies, though it can come close by saying that we're composed of bodies. In almost every other respect, however, trialism is equal, if not superior, to its materialist and dualistic rivals. Thus, insofar as trialism says we're composed of bodies, it can preserve all the other advantages of materialism, including its other theoretical virtues, unity of minds and bodies, and its account of materiality of human beings, including the goodness of the body and the badness of death. And insofar as trialism says we're composed of immaterial souls, it can also preserve the chief advantages of substance dualism, including our differences from non-human animals and the immateriality, the immortality of the soul. The only place a question arises has to do with how well trialism can be said to fit with traditional Christian views of the afterlife, in particular with that interim state I mentioned. This turns out to be an important question and one that we'll have to return to, since it affects the proper understanding of Aquinas' views. But before we do that, let's first get clear about how Aquinas himself is thinking of human nature. And his conception is what we'll refer to as hypomorphism. Aquinas thinks of all reality in broadly Aristotelian terms, and he thinks of the material world in particular in terms of matter and form, or houle and morphe in Aristotle's Greek. It's for the same reason that he conceives of material substances in general, and human beings in particular, as hylomorphic compounds, that is, entities composed of both matter and form, entities that have matter and form as parts. Now, Aquinas' hylomorphic conception of human nature bears important similarities to all three of the traditional conceptions that I mentioned. In the end, I don't think it can properly be interpreted in terms of any one of them. Even so, if we want to make progress in understanding his conception, I think there's no better place to begin than with its connection to each of these other three. And I'll begin with the similarities to materialism. Like the materialists, Aquinas identifies human beings with their bodies, with living bodies or organisms. And like the materialist, he thinks of such bodies or organisms as a type of material substance. So he identifies Socrates with his body and thinks of his body as a material substance. What's more, Aquinas thinks of bodies in general as having a special connection to matter. That's why it's a material substance. And human minds or souls as having a special connection to form. Indeed, in the case of human beings, he identifies the soul with a part of the body. Namely, a part that makes the body alive and endows it with the capacity for rational thought and willing. In principle, one could take this part to be wholly material, such as the brain. In light of all this, it might seem that Aquinas' hylomorphism is best understood as a type of materialism. But in fact, this can't be right. And the reasons for this become clear when we compare the similarities of Aquinas' hylomorphism to substance dualism. Although Aquinas thinks of forms as parts of bodies, he does not think of them as ordinary material parts, such as the brain. Indeed, in the special case of the human soul, he insists that it must be conceived of as a type of immaterial substance. Indeed, one which survives the death of the body and continues to support rational thought and willing in its absence. What's more, Aquinas makes it clear that he takes the human body, which is a material substance, and the human soul, which is an immaterial substance, to be the only two types of substance required to account for our nature as human beings. In light of all this, it might seem that Aquinas' hylomorphism is best understood as a type of substance dualism rather than materialism. But in fact, that can't be right either, and the reasons for this become clear when you compare the similarities of Aquinas' hylomorphism to trialism. As we've seen, substance dualists identify human beings with their souls, and hence take them to be wholly immaterial beings. As we've also seen, however, Aquinas rejects this identification, insisting instead that human beings must be identified with their bodies, and so are themselves material substances. What's more, Aquinas insists that human beings are not only distinct from their souls, but possess them in a way that a whole possesses its parts. But this in turn requires that human beings are at least partly immaterial beings for him. Indeed, as Aquinas sees it, human beings are partly material and partly immaterial beings composed of both matter and form, at least when those things are appropriately related. It might be wondered why Aquinas describes human beings as material substances, given that they're composed at least partly of an immaterial substance, or soul. The answer is that, as he's using the term, something qualifies as material just in case it possesses matter. This is what he thinks distinguishes human beings as well as other creatures in the material world from God and the angels, who are wholly immaterial. They don't have any matter. Even so, since Aquinas thinks of human beings as unique in possessing both material and immaterial parts, it would be better, I think, to characterize human beings on his conception as complex substances, as the trialists do, rather than merely as material or immaterial substances, as materialists and substance dualists do. Indeed, as we can now see, Aquinas conceives of the relation between the matter and form of the human being in the same way that trialists conceive of the relation between the human body and the soul, namely as a relation that holds between distinct things that are united to each other in such a way as to compose a further substance. In light of all this, it might seem that in the end, Aquinas' hylomorphism is best understood as a form of trialism. But in fact, even this can't be right. And the reasons for this become clear when we consider its differences from all three of those conceptions. Insofar as Aquinas conceives of human beings as having material and immaterial parts that are related by something like substantial union, his conception of human nature obviously comes close to that of the trialists. Even so, there is an important difference. Unlike the trialists, Aquinas does not conceive of the material part of a human being as another type of substance. Indeed, what he calls the matter of a human being is best thought of not as a substance, but as a kind of stuff out of which material substances or bodies are made. Substances are things, he thinks, that can exist on their own, but stuffs cannot. We might indicate the lack of independence here by putting a dotted line around Socrates' matter. Now, the fact that Aquinas takes human beings to be bodies, having both material and immaterial parts, leads him to think of human bodies themselves as only partly material substances. And this, in turn, distinguishes his hylomorphism not only from trialism, but also from materialism and substance dualism. For the proponents of all three of those traditional conceptions take for granted that human bodies are wholly material substances. In the end, therefore, I think that Aquinas' hylomorphic conception of human beings must be understood in a way that distinguishes it from each of the other conceptions we've considered. And as I've indicated at F on your handout, we can understand it in terms of five ways. So there's just two types of substances required to account for our nature, partly material substances and wholly immaterial ones. Our bodies are partly material substances. Our minds are wholly immaterial substances. We are identical to our bodies, and we possess both our minds as well as our matter or material stuff as parts. And as a result, we are by nature partly material and partly immaterial beings. In short, I think it's clear that Aquinas' hylomorphism does provide us with a distinctive conception of human beings, one which, for the same reasons, as I'll now try to explain, is both historically and philosophically significant. The characterization of Aquinas' hylomorphism that I've just given you is historically significant insofar as it provides us with a novel interpretation of his views. Philosophers have often wondered how best to characterize Aquinas' conception of human beings. I think it's fair to say, moreover, that their dispute has focused on the question of whether we should think of his conception as a type of substance dualism. So non-historical readers of Aquinas, especially those non-historians of philosophy, especially those in the analytic tradition, tend to lump Aquinas together with the substance dualist because of his views about the immortality of the soul. Though I do know of at least one person who's identified him as a dualist. By contrast, historians of philosophy, and especially Thomistic commentators, have typically taken the opposite view, insisting that whatever else Aquinas is, he is not a substance dualism because of his denial of their souls. Indeed, historians of philosophy typically agree that Aquinas' conception marks out a distinctive position midway between materialism and substance dualism, and their disagreement, if they have one, focuses on the precise relationship of his view to these two extremes. If my interpretation is right, however, both parties go wrong in thinking of Aquinas' hylomorphism solely in terms of its connection to materialism and substance dualism. I agree with both parties in thinking that Aquinas' views can't be understood in terms of materialism, and I agree with the historians against the non-historians in thinking that they can't be understood in terms of substance dualism. Though, to be fair, non-historians sometimes use the term dualism in an exceeding broad sense. Even so, I think that if Aquinas' views are going to be located on the cusp between two views, they ought to be located on that between dualism and trialism, rather than materialism and substance. Now, as these remarks about the historical significance of Aquinas' hylomorphism help to bring out, his views are also philosophically significant as well, marking out a distinctive position whose possibility has been almost entirely overlooked in the contemporary context. For the sake of clarity, I've included a table at G on the handout, highlighting the precise relationship of hylomorphism to these other preconceptions. I use shading to indicate similarities, and its absence to indicate differences. As this table helps to make clear, Aquinas' hylomorphism shares important similarities with all three traditional conceptions, despite being distinct from each. In particular, it shares the most in common with trialism, including its account of both the nature of human beings and the relationship to their souls. It shares the next most in common with substance dualism, including the number of types of substances it posits to account for our nature as human beings, and it shares just one important thing in common with materialism, namely the identification of us with our bodies. Though even here, hylomorphism departs from materialism in thinking of human bodies as only partly material. The distinctive nature of Aquinas' hylomorphism gives it, I think, some distinctive advantages as a conception of human beings, at least along the parameters we've been considering. Here, I would refer you to the table at H on the handout, which will remind you of the relevant parameters and also show you how all four conceptions fare relative to each. Given what I said earlier about trialism's advantages as a conception of human beings, I think it's especially significant that Aquinas' hylomorphism shares all of trialism's advantages, but none of its distinctive costs. Note that Aquinas' hylomorphism also does better, at least in terms of sheer number of advantages, than either materialism or substance dualism. There can be no doubt that hylomorphism is worse off than materialism when it comes to theoretical parsimony, but this is the only respect in which it's worse off. And in any case, materialism won't be a live option for anyone committed to upholding the immortality of the soul, much less to the immateriality of human beings. This suggests that at least when it comes to the parameters we're considering, the real choice is between hylomorphism and substance dualism. But even here, hylomorphism might appear to be the clear victor, since only it can do justice both to the materiality and the immateriality of human beings. Can we conclude, therefore, that hylomorphism is the best overall conception of human beings? Not quite. As noted earlier, there's still a question about how well hylomorphism fares relative to substance dualism when it comes to the afterlife, especially that interim state. Before we can make any final decisions, therefore, we must address the question of the afterlife head on. Let's briefly turn, therefore, to Aquinas' views about human death. Death, as we've been thinking of it, is just the separation of the soul from the body. Insofar as Aquinas accepts the immortality of the soul, he's obviously committed to saying that the soul survives this separation. But what about the whole human being? When Socrates' soul separates from his matter, does Socrates himself survive? This question turns out to be difficult to answer for Aquinas, since to my knowledge, he never explicitly addresses it. Even so, we can distinguish two models of human death corresponding to the two possible answers he could give. Both models will obviously presuppose his hylomorphism. So, consider again our human being Socrates, who's a complex substance for Aquinas, composed of both matter and form, matter and soul. Moreover, let's begin by considering him at some time prior to his death, and for good measure, we can add in a time at which he will later be resurrected. Now, according to the first model, which I'll call cessationism, when a human being such as Socrates dies, he utterly or she utterly ceases to exist. Thus, when Socrates dies, say as a result of drinking hemlock, and his soul separates from his matter, Socrates himself goes out of existence only to return at the general resurrection of the dead, when his separated soul will reunite with his matter. So here's my attempt to pictorially represent what happens. So you can imagine Socrates is approaching death. Oh, his soul separates from his body, his matter. Oh, but it's coming back. There he is. Okay. By contrast, according to the second model, which I'll call survivalism, human beings survive their death along with their separated souls. Thus, what goes out of existence when Socrates dies, or when his soul separates from his matter, is not Socrates himself, but only his body. Likewise, what returns at the general resurrection of the dead, when his separated soul is reunited with matter, is not Socrates. He's been there all along, but only Socrates' body. So here's my pictorial representation of this. Socrates approaches death. His soul separates from the matter, but Socrates survives along with the soul, only to be resurrected later on. Okay, I've given you definitions of these two models, as well as the sort of snapshot illustration of them on the handout at I and L. Assuming the basic distinction between these two models is clear, the $64 billion question is once again, which of them is best? I think it's fair to say that Aquinas' commentators nowadays typically interpret his hylomorphism in terms of the cessationist model of human death. Indeed, cessationism is now often referred to in the secondary literature as the standard interpretation. And it's not hard to see why. It appears to be straightforwardly entailed by what Aquinas says about the materiality of human beings, and even more specifically about our nature as bodies and the badness of human death. Here's why. So here's the evidence for the cessationist interpretation. Insofar as we just are our bodies, it would seem that we must go out of existence when we die. For Aquinas thinks that it's clear that our bodies are corrupted or destroyed when we die, and we're just our bodies. Again, in order to explain the badness of death, Aquinas thinks that we must say that when we die, we undergo a substantial change. Death is not like stepping off a ship or changing your clothes. In fact, it's not an accidental change of any sort. It's a substantial change or corruption. But it's hard to see how a human being could undergo a change of this sort without ceasing to exist altogether. Despite these two pieces of evidence in its favor, cessationism has some pretty serious costs, both as an interpretation of Aquinas and as a model of human death in its own right. Here I'm thinking in particular of what it says about the afterlife. And there are really two problems here. The first is what we might call the problem of postmortem thinking and willing. Aquinas is emphatic that when my soul is in the body, it's not my soul that thinks or wills, but only the whole human being, me. But what about after death, when my soul continues to support thought and willing? Evidently, if cessationism is true, my soul must then begin doing some things it's never done prior to that point, namely thinking and willing, on its own, since I won't be there to do it. And evidently, my soul must also quit doing those same things once I'm resurrected, since then I'll again be there to do them. This is made all the more strange by the fact that cessationists themselves admit that my soul is not itself a person, for Aquinas. But how could anything other than a person think or will? So that's the first problem. The second problem, closely related to this first one, concerns postmortem punishment and reward. As we've seen, Aquinas thinks that immediately following death, someone or something is punished or rewarded for the deeds I performed in life. But if cessationism is true, it can't be me, since I won't be around. Hence, it must be my soul, since it appears to be the only thing that can take my place. But this, again, is a very strange consequence, especially if we add that the soul is not itself a person. How could anyone other than me be punished or rewarded for what I've done? And even if it could make sense of another person being punished or rewarded in my place, how could it be something that's not even a person, like the soul? To be fair, at least some of Aquinas' interpreters are aware of these problems and have come up with some really ingenious suggestions for reconciling cessationism both with Aquinas' texts and with traditional Christian teachings about the afterlife. Even so, the problems with this model of human death seem to me significant enough to warrant a closer look at our other model, namely survivalism. Survivalism has the advantage of avoiding precisely the problems that plague cessationism. According to the survivalist, I survive my death, so there's no question about who does my thinking or willing after death. I do. Nor is there any question about who's punished or rewarded for my deeds in life. I am. The problem for survivalism, however, is how to reconcile it with the very considerations that motivate cessationism in the first place. In particular, with what Aquinas says about the materiality of human beings. After all, how can we survive our death if we're just our bodies, but they don't survive? How can we survive if dying itself requires us to undergo a substantial change? As it turns out, we get answers to both of these questions if we consider them in light of certain things that Aquinas says about the incarnation of Christ. Let us therefore very briefly, consider Aquinas' understanding of this doctrine. According to the Christian doctrine of the incarnation, God became a human being. More specifically, at a certain point of time and in the person of Christ, God took on human nature, thereby became fully human without ceasing to be fully divine, lived out a perfectly sinless life, eventually suffered and died, but on the third day was resurrected from the dead. Obviously, this is a complicated doctrine, but I want to focus on Aquinas' understanding of what was involved when God, in Christ, became human, died, and was resurrected. So let's look briefly at just each of those things, beginning with his becoming human. In line with tradition going back to the 5th century, Aquinas takes the doctrine of the incarnation to apply that when Christ became human, he did so by taking on a body and soul. Or more precisely, for Aquinas, he took on matter and a soul and thereby became a certain type of substance, namely a human body. Okay, but what about when he died? Here again, in line with tradition, Aquinas assumes that when Christ died, his soul was separated from his matter, and hence he ceased to be a human being. But after 3 days, when he was resurrected, his soul was reunited with matter, and he became a human being again. As these brief remarks suggest, Aquinas is thinking of the incarnation and Christ's death in particular along the lines of survivalism. Christ is God, so obviously when he dies, he doesn't cease to exist altogether. That would be impossible. On the contrary, he merely ceases to be a certain type of material substance or body, namely a human being. But if Christ ceases to be a certain type of substance when he dies, then he clearly undergoes a substantial change. And of course, something similar happens when he's resurrected and once again becomes a human being. Now, this survivalist model of the incarnation gives us all we need to solve our initial problem about how to reconcile survivalism with what hylomorphism says about the materiality of human beings. When Christ becomes human, he becomes a certain type of material substance, and when he dies, he ceases to be that same type of substance, even though he doesn't thereby cease to exist. So why couldn't the same be true of us? Why couldn't we die, cease to be human, but continue to exist? Likewise, Christ undergoing a substantial change at death doesn't require him to cease to exist. So once again, why should it be any different for us? Why couldn't we undergo a substantial change at death and not cease to exist? Indeed, insofar as Christians have always taken Christ's death and resurrection to be a sort of model for understanding our own, as Paul suggests in 1 Corinthians 15, a commitment to the incarnation would seem to provide at least some indirect support for survivalism. There's one remaining problem, but I think I'm going to skip over it in the interest of time. Let's bring this thing to a close. Okay, let's consider what we're able to conclude at this point. First, with regard to survivalism versus cessationism, I think it's clear that survivalism provides us with a better hylomorphic model of human death than cessationism. There's nothing to prevent us from interpreting Aquinas' hylomorphism in terms of survivalism, On the contrary, there's both textual and systematic grounds for doing so. What's more, if we do interpret his views in this way, we can avoid all of those knotty problems having to do with the afterlife. And that seems like a good thing, both in itself and for what it tells us about hylomorphism versus substance dualism. Remember, we had a question about how hylomorphism fares relative to substance dualism when it comes to the afterlife. But what if what I've just said is correct, the answer should be clear. Hylomorphism fares just as well as substance dualism with respect to the afterlife, at least when it's interpreted along survivalist lines. But then, doesn't it just follow that hylomorphism so interpreted provides the best overall conception of human beings, at least along the parameters we've been considering? Not quite, for it must be recognized that the survivalist interpretation of hylomorphism does bring with it an important cost, namely the requirement that a complex object, a human being, can be composed at least temporarily of just a single part, namely the soul. This is a strange consequence, to say the least. Indeed, one might even think it's incoherent. For if an object is complex, that is to say, if it has parts at all, it might appear to be impossible for it to have only one part. One-part objects are at very least rare, to say the least. At this point, however, we must be careful. Aquinas can allow that it's impossible for an object to be composed of a single part throughout its entire career. His view doesn't require that. What it requires is merely this. An object that starts off having many parts can come temporarily to be composed of just one of them. That, I submit, is not incoherent. Strange? Yes. Surprising? Definitely. But impossible? No. Or so it seems to me. I realize, of course, that not everyone will share my enthusiasm for the survivalist model of human death, or even for the type of hylomorphism that underlies it. In fact, I can easily imagine reflection on the very same considerations that lead me to embrace both might well tip the balance for someone else in favor of another conception, or perhaps even in favor of cessationism. I do, however, hope at least to have convinced you of the significance of Aquinas' views on our topic, as well as the value of approaching human nature and death from the perspective of his broadly Aristotelian hylomorphism. If my interpretation is correct, his views seem to stake out a number of dialectical options that have yet to receive the attention they deserve, as well as to identify a host of considerations that must be evaluated if we are to arrive at the truth about what happens to us after death. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.